my beloved brethren and sisters in the bonds of the covenant. This is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of Elohim, blessed the children of Israel before his death. We know that in the Hebrew, the book of Deuteronomy, whereas it means repetition or second law in the Greek where we get the word Deuteronomy from, in Hebrew it means these be the words. And that features quite frequently at the beginning of the chapter as well. The chapter we have before us this morning, at least chapter 33, are the last of the words of one of the greatest men of all time. And his last words are a blessing. This is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of Elohim, blessed the children of Israel before his death. We would perhaps suggest that this is a type of Christ. What does Psalm 68 tell us? Thou hast ascended on high, thou hast led captivity captive. In Christ's death, he accomplished the fulfillment of the first installment, if you like, of God's plan of salvation. And it's not, therefore, insignificant that these blessings which Moses blessed the children of Israel appeared just before his death. And their future to our day, these blessings are not blessings which have ever been realized in the nation, the history of the nation of Israel. I forgot my time, 10-2, okay. The blessing of Israel by Moses before his death, says Brother Thomas, is unquestionably a prophecy of their happy condition in the latter day, when dwelling in safety alone and treading upon the high places of the earth. That's from Eureka, Volume 2. And so their future, how do we know that their future? Well, we'll come and look at the blessings in due course. We could divide the chapter into three parts, if you will. Verses 2 to 3 give us this picture of Yahweh coming in from Sinai. The burden of the blessings are in verses 4 to 28. And then again, in verses 26 to 29, we have the picture of the everlasting arms, which we look at in due course. And really what we have, therefore, is it's almost like the apocalyptic vision, where each element of the vision is encapsulated within each other. And we have here a picture of, to begin, to show how Yahweh will come in. So these blessings cannot be realized without the direct intervention of Yahweh. And equally then, at the end of the chapter, we have a demonstration of the power of Yahweh. And in a very shadowy illustration, just how Yahweh's power will be realized. Brother Thomas says that he translates verse 2, Yahweh came in from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He caused to shine forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of the holy. From his right hand a fiery mandate for them. Yea, he loved the people. All his saints are in thy hand. Now this, brethren and sisters, I believe, is a response to the invasion of the King of the North. This is Yahweh's intervention in the affairs of his land. As he said, he will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. And this is the response when all the nations of the earth are gathered together against his people. So how do we know then that this is future? We could say that this was fulfilled in the days of Israel, when they came from Sinai, and the second generation, which was the obedient generation, took the land. Well, of course, we bear in mind the words of Paul in Romans, that God calleth those things which be not as though they were. Bearing in mind that this is the past tense, Yahweh came from Sinai. So we're trying to make this applicable to the future when it's written in the past tense. So we do have that verse in Romans, which is quite a frequent feature of the scriptures, where God says that something has happened, or and he says it because it's as good as done. If God says something, it's done. It may not be done now, it may not be done for 2,000 years, but it will be done. Consider it done. That same psalm which we looked at, Psalm 68, the chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them, as in Sinai the holy. Thou hast ascended on high, thou hast led captivity captive, thou hast received gifts for men. The Lord said, I will bring again from Bashan, I will bring my people again from the depths of the sea. So there we clearly have a reference to the future. The chariots of Elohim, the forces of Yahweh coming from Sinai, and that's future. And obviously it's future because we know that Christ did not ascend on high until probably upwards of 1500 years after this. The most interesting reference, of course, is Habakkuk, chapter 3, verse 3. God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. So it reads in the King James Version. But more correctly, we could read that Eloah shall come from Teman or from the south, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. So while we have in the King James Version, God came from Teman in Habakkuk chapter 3, more correctly, it should be Eloah shall come from Teman. So we have the future presented to us clearly there. Does that mean we can translate Deuteronomy chapter 33 differently? No, it doesn't, because in Habakkuk chapter 3, the word for coming, or what we have came from Teman, is Yahvoh. And that does mean, that is a future tense. But in Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 2, it's a different word. So we have to leave this translation much as it is. It is in the past tense, and I have a suggestion for that. But what we have presented to us then in this verse is the commencement of the march of the rainbowed angel. And we even have some details here of the route of the march of the rainbowed angel. We find that they start from Sinai, which of course is where the judgment takes place. The judgments on the nations cannot take place until the household be judged. So they march from Sinai, they march to the east, towards Teman, and then march west again into the land of, they march northeast towards Teman, and then march west into the land of Israel, just like Israel did in the days of Moses and Joshua. They entered through the Valley of Achor. But this chapter then is prophetic, just in the same way as Balaam's parable is prophetic, and this is why I believe we have this written to us in past tense. It's because of what was witnessed there, and the children of Israel in the wilderness were not the finished article. We know that even their inheritance of the land was not a permanent inheritance. It's a pictorial representation of a much greater fulfillment. Balaam said in his parable, in Numbers 24, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel, as the valleys are they spread forth, as gardens by the river's side, as the trees of line aloes which Yahweh hath planted, and as cedar trees beside the waters. Clearly, this immense encampment of unprecedented order had a massive impression on Balaam's mind. He was inspired to write these words, I appreciate that. But it made an immense impression on his mind. At the same time, there was a much deeper than just what Balaam saw. What God is giving to us through those words of Balaam is a picture of the beautiful and yet formidable sight of the latter day promised seed of Israel. And let's hope that that's you and I, as well as all the greats of the past, like Moses and Joshua. This Israel that Balaam saw in prophecy, he said, I will see him, but not nigh. Balaam wouldn't have anything to do with that. He'd be with the goats. But what he was seeing was the eternal spirit, our Messiah, and his brethren. And so we have there then an indication that many of the transactions in the wilderness were a representation of a much greater force, which would be revealed. So Moses says, Yahweh came up from Sinai. He came up from Sinai with the children of Israel. With that angel, he said, my name is among him, or in him. But that's not really the the real deep meaning of this verse. That's just the shadowy picture of a much greater meaning. And so while we are safe to leave it in the past tense, it's really telling us that it's a picture of the future. And this is the reason for the difference, because what we have presented to us in these books of the law is the history of the children of Israel as a pictorial representation of the saints with Christ in glory coming, whereas Habakkuk is giving us just the raw prophecy, if you like, if that makes any sense. Now, of course, we're talking about the end of the Gentile times here. In actual fact, we're talking about the end times of the sixth. We're living in the time period of the sixth vial. The sixth vial of Revelation, of course, is the drying up of the river Euphrates, and that's, we don't have time to go into this, but that's really pertinent to the chapter we're looking at, because for all this to happen, the Turkish power had to be dried up. For the saints to be manifested, and hopefully we'll have time to look at that at the end of the chapter, for the saints to be manifested, the whole power of the Gentiles had to be dried up in that area. So the Constantinopolitan power had to be weakened, and that's the fulfillment of the sixth vial. All these scenes that we are seeing here bring the sixth vial to a close. It's when the saints appear to judge the nations gather together into Armageddon. Of course, the sixth vial is not the end of the judgments. The seventh vial begins the greatest judgments of all time. But the destruction of Russia is in the closing scenes of the sixth vial, which we're living in. We would also say here, and I hope I don't lose anyone here in some of this, but this is also before the Aeonian Gospel, of course. Yahweh comes up from Sinai. The Aeonian Gospel is not issued until Christ stands on Mount Zion. It says in verse 2, from his right hand went a fiery law for them. And in verse 4, Moses commanded us a law, even the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. This is the Aeonian Gospel that Christ is coming from Sinai to proclaim. Now, of course, we understand that gospel means good news, but it depends how we respond to that good news. Do we respond to the call of the gospel now? Will the nations respond to this law which goes forth from Zion? We know that for the most part they won't. So, Brother Thomas says, I won't read the whole section, but he says, my present conviction, therefore, is that the gathering together of the national armies against Jerusalem is after the appearance of Christ in the south. So Christ appears in the south, and I'm sure I forgot to look at it before I came, but I'm sure in the last terrible 40 years by Brother Grocott, he says that it would appear that the land of unwalled villages is unwalled because Christ has become a protectorate to them. So it seems almost incongruous that Russia would have ever invade and successfully take Jerusalem when Christ is in the land. When the saints have all been judged and the sheep separated from the goats, that Russia would ever invade. And yet, when we look at Napoleon, who's a great type of Christ, not in his character, I hasten to add, but he's a great type of Christ in the mission he was sent to accomplish, he did much the same thing. He lured the Austrians and the Prussians and the Russians at the Battle of Austerlitz. He lured them into a trap. When they thought they were about to win, they threw all their forces at Napoleon, and realizing that Napoleon had other columns masked behind him. So I think what we have there is almost like a luring. I will put hooks in thy jaws, we're told. The Russians will be lured into the land. They seem certain of success. And they do gain success to an extent. They've expelled the British from the land. They will take half of the city captive. The women shall be rifled. And of course, we know the postscript to that, he shall be broken and none shall help him, Daniel chapter 11. So this fiery law then is what the saints and Christ are coming up from Sinai to introduce. So this then is the picture of Yahweh coming from Sinai. And it's all so that he can redeem his people to himself again. The blessings then, beginning in chapter 6, can be seen to be related. We can sometimes read a blessing and think, "Oh, it's all good news." But we have the reality of judgment in this as well. Look at verse 10. They shall teach Jacob thy judgments, and Israel thy Lord. They shall put incense before thee, and whole burnt sacrifice upon thine altar. We don't have time to look into this, but the types and shadows around the Feast of Tabernacles and the Day of Atonement tell us that this is a sort of a picture of the great judgment, when there will be a great sacrifice of all the nations. The blood will flow. And this is what Israel are blessed to be able to partake in. They will have been themselves placed under the rod, so that the rebels will be purged out from among them, and they themselves then will execute these judgments with the saints as their commanders. Verse 11, bless Yahweh his substance, and accept the work of his hands. Smite through the loins of them that rise against him, and of them that hate him, that they rise not again. Verse 13, of Joseph he said, blessed be of Yahweh be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth beneath. Verse 16, and the precious things of the earth and fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph. This is the wealth of the nations that they will acquire when they destroy and subdue these nations. Verse 19, they shall call the people unto the mountain. There they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness, for they shall suck of the abundance of the seas and of treasures hid in the sand. Israel will be presented now as an acceptable sacrifice to God, in the sense that they will be faithful, every one of them. And they will execute the judgments written as God's battle axe and weapon of war. And we could look at all the other verses as well, and we don't have time. So now, I'll just briefly mention a few things of the blessings. Here's one which may be interesting for discussion later. I did think about it, but I don't have a suggestion. I have a suggestion, and that's all it is. Simeon is not mentioned in these blessings. And we ask the question, why? Well, it's not unique to find that a tribe is missing from blessings. We know that, I think Dan is missing from the tribes listed in the Apocalypse, when we're talking about the sealing. Dan is not mentioned there. So the fact that there's a certain amount of flux in the listing of the tribes is not unique. But, you know, there's a good reason for it, and I'd be interested to hear what the brethren have to say about that. Is it perhaps that a Simeon was an instrument of cruelty? And this is not the time for cruelty with regards to Israel. This is a time where the Aeonian gospel will go forth, and there will be immense judgment, but not raw fleshly cruelty. There's a great difference. It's unlawful for us to kill. Will it be unlawful for us to kill when Christ returns? Not at all. So is it because Simeon was an instrument of cruelty? Well, perhaps. But you might say, well, Levi's mentioned here. Of course, Levi, in the wilderness sojourns, gave themselves to Yahweh and remained obedient. There's some thoughts, and I'd be interested to hear if anyone's got any better suggestion than that. Verse 8, of course, we're talking directly of Christ there. Let thy Urim and thy Thummim be with thy Holy One, whom thou didst prove at Massah. We could translate it, let thy Thummim and thy Urim be with the man, thine Holy One, Ish Chasidecha in Hebrew, whom thou didst prove at Massah. Well, of course, this has not been fulfilled. Levi has even now not accepted the Messiah. They have not accepted the man, their Holy One. They're still in rejection of him. So this is clearly future. And, of course, we think of Ezra, where there were many who had forgotten their genealogy, and they were told not to partake of any of the holy things until they should stand up a priest with Urim and Thummim. And that's, of course, Christ. Verse 25, and I'm just putting some thought for, we don't have time to look at each verse. Verse 25, iron and brass. Thy shoes shall be iron and brass, and as thy day so shall thy strength be. Or under thy feet perhaps shall be iron and brass. When we look at Deuteronomy chapter 28, we find that over their heads would be iron and brass. Whereas here, the iron and brass powers will be subdued before them. And I had a couple more comments, but it would be tragedy to not consider this chapter without looking at verses 26 to the end, where we read of the ale of Yeshurun and his mighty arms. Brother Thomas translates, there is none like the ale of Yeshurun, who rides upon the heavens in thy help, and in his excellency upon the skies. The mighty ones of the east thy refuge, and underneath the arms of the Olam. And he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, destroy. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. Some of the younger brethren and sisters may think, well, why do we keep having to have Brother Thomas's translation? Well, as was said to me this week, Brother Thomas didn't leave any stone unturned. And there are some things, even down to a plurality or singular, Brother Thomas recognized the critical importance of making some of these things correct. So, for example, we read in our version, "Who rideth upon the heaven in thy help?" Brother Thomas makes that heavens, because all the powers of the earth will be cast. There is only one heaven in reality, of course, but all the powers of the earth will be brought under Christ. So all the kings who are represented by heavens, heavens represent the power of the various nations and the ruling powers. All of those ruling powers will be brought under Christ. The mighty ones of the east, we find that in our version, the eternal God. But Brother Thomas rightly translates that as the mighty ones of the east, because in Hebrew it's the Elohai Kedem. Kedem means east. So it should have been better translated mighty ones of the east. So again, we have a picture of salvation and destruction here. Because we have the arms presented to us. Now, just quickly, how can salvation and destruction go together? Well, we think of Christ in his very work. In his work of salvation, he destroyed the flesh. That's exactly the same picture of Christ at his return. The world can't see salvation and destruction together. Everything's all good, but not with God's plan. For all the nations to be blessed in Abraham, there has to be a great destruction first. Psalm 89 says, "O Yahweh Tzevaoth, who is a strong Yah like to thee, or to thy faithfulness round about thee? Thou rulest the raging of the sea, when the waves thereof arise, thou stillest them. Thou hast broken Rahab, or Egypt, in pieces, as one that is slain. Thou hast scattered thine enemies with thy strong arm. Thou hast a mighty arm, strong is thy hand, and high is thy right hand." Isaiah 51 verse 9, "Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O arm of Yahweh." Isaiah 63 verse 5, "And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my fury it upheld me. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and make them drunk in my fury, and I will bring down their strength to the earth." So arms, then, it doesn't take a genius to work out, are symbolically used to represent power, or military forces, or even sovereign authority. And in verse 26, then, we have the arms of the Olam. These are the armies of Israel. We think of the cherubic wings. When they're outstretched, they're in belligerent manifestation. They're in military mode. When they're lowered, then it's peaceful. And that's the same with the arm of God. We think of when God said his arm was outstretched against Israel. In other words, he was punishing them. And he had his forces to deliver that. And in Daniel chapter 10, verse 5, "His body also was like the beryl, and his face is the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude." Now this brings us closer to the real substance of this prophecy, because what Daniel chapter 10 deals with, obviously, is the resurrection, the anastasis, or standing up, of the saints. And in these verses, we have the resurrection presented to us. How is that? Well, as we said, verse 27, the eternal God is better rendered the mighty ones of the east. But east is not telling us where they come from or where they're going to. In fact, it doesn't have any reference to the compass. What is really referring to is what is also taught in Apocalypse 16. "The sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east," or, as Brother Thomas renders it, "kings of a sun's rising might be prepared." And here is the nub of the issue. Who is the sun? It's the sun of righteousness in Malachi 4, who is to rise with healing in his beams. His enlivening rays will call all the saints forth from their tombs of memory. And subsequent to that, they would be sent forth to execute the judgments. And we could have expanded that, but we're really out of time. And I was asked to speak on Deuteronomy chapter 34 as well. So I'll just put a few comments forward on Deuteronomy 34. That this then is the end of the life of Moses, one of the greatest men that has ever walked this earth, prophet, priest, and king. There arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom Yahweh knew face to face. And as you read in verse 5 of chapter 33, he was king in Yeshurun, and he was never crowned, but he took the position of having absolute authority over God's people. He was king in Yeshurun when the heads of the people and the tribes of Israel were gathered together. They rejected Moses just as they rejected Christ, but eventually they accepted him, just as they will eventually accept Christ. Brother Grocott says, just in conclusion, death is not sad if the life has been lived wholly in and unto God. It is but a brief rest from faithful labour. And what faithful labour Moses gave his Creator. And yet, as Brother Lenny read that chapter, you know, Brother Lenny put some feeling into reading that, and he was told to go up into Mount Nebo, look over the land. This was the land that his people would inherit. He knew that he would also inherit it. Not now, but as Hebrews 11 tells us, by faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of reward.